Welcome to Energy Thinks, a podcast about how the oil and gas industry will lead into the energy future. I'm Tisha Schuler, your host and the CEO of Adamantine Energy. This year, I am focusing on two essential ingredients for energy leadership today. The first is a vision for the energy future that is compelling, that's an antidote to all the apocalypses that you hear left and right. The second part is executing on the nuts and bolts of that vision in a way that builds trust, that we are actually making the investments that are required to lead into the energy future. So today's guest can speak to both of these things. Regina Mayer is the Global Head of Clients and Markets at KPMG. She's a recognized thought leader on disruptive trends. You'll hear that I brought her on to talk particularly about a CEO survey that they had. Regina is the host of KPMG's annual Global Energy Conference. And as you'll hear in our show today, she came both back from Davos and from COP last year. So she has some insights from both of those. Regina holds a bachelor's degree from Cornell and a master's degree from Harvard. You can hear more about Regina's biography in our show notes. I think you'll enjoy this short and sweet, jam-packed conversation with Regina Mayer. Regina Mayer, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me on the Energy Thinks podcast.
Wonderful to be here, Tisha. Thanks for having me.
So last fall, KPMG released your 2023 CEO Outlook, and earlier this year, I got to see you present on it. It was very compelling, which is why I wanted to talk to you today. In that survey, you talked to over 1,300 CEOs, and in that, you discovered, for example, that geopolitics and political uncertainty are the leading perceived risk among CEOs. I'm curious, you have worked with the energy sector and our audience is oil and gas executives. What do you see as the biggest risks specifically for oil and gas companies in the years ahead?
The results for the energy companies were largely the same, geopolitical risk and uncertainty. And I think what's important to note is the question is focused on what's your risk to growth. So they were seeing a lot of changes in the geopolitical environment, and that was across all CEOs. The energy companies, they're probably more adept at dealing with geopolitical uncertainty because we've been through it. Sources of natural resources come from all parts of the world, and we've had varying degrees of cooperation given whatever time frame we're on. So I think that remains a staple within the energy companies' lists of risks. I think they're all trying to grapple with the ongoing demand for talent, right? So we had the peaks and then COVID, and we've been grappling with a lack of petroleum engineers coming into the business. Is the business continuing to be sexy enough for the next generation? So I think talent continues to be a question. How they leverage technology and AI, a big part of the risk formula, and then what that opens them up to cyber. ESG and managing the energy transition, depending where you stand, depends on where you sit. Do you think peak oil is in 2050 or in 2090 or in 2030? There's varying projections of what that looks like and what that means and how energy companies are responding. So I would say the risk profile has been relatively stable, but the fact that geopolitics jumped to be number one of all risks across all CEOs, we published a study on October 3rd and October 7th, we saw the conflict in Israel and Gaza erupt. And I don't think anyone was expecting that.
Yeah, that really puts a fine point on geopolitical risk before October 7th was already the top one, which I guess is in some ways prescient because it turns out, yes, the world has changed and continues to change. I'm interested in a lot of the things you said, but one in particular, environment, climate change, ESG, these are things that oil and gas companies have to navigate, I think, in a very unique way. And there's these pressures of ESG and anti-ESG. Now, in the CEO survey, the environment and climate change fell two spots. So I'm curious, what does that tell you about, how does that inform how you advise energy executives? Like, is this something becoming less important, more nuanced? What's the way that you're thinking about it?
Well, I do think that you could make the assumption that because it fell to the bottom of the five in this year's survey, that that means it's less important. My interpretation would be different. The interpretation would be it's really because they have a plan of attack for addressing it. So remember, the question is, what is your greatest risk to growth? And they've been factoring this component in of how do I deal with ESG? How do I deal with climate change? How do I embrace the fact that there is going to be an energy transition, regardless of when you anticipate that that's coming. How do I manage my strategy if I believe I'm the last man standing in a fossil fuel friendly kind of an environment? How do I decarbonize? What are my pathways to decarbonization? What new businesses can I invest in? And can I generate the returns that my shareholders expect? So I think it's much more ingrained into everyday business. It's ingrained in their capital allocation already. They have plans for reporting. Most of them already are reporting on a number of items. They're going to have to face regulations that will require even more transparent reporting. So I don't read into the fact that it dropped to 5 on the list from, you know, maybe number 1 a few years ago as meaning it's less important. I just think people have rolled up their sleeves and they're getting on with it. I do think the danger is it has become politicized. And now that you have this phrase green shushing, that, you know, you have to maybe go undercover with your activities or maybe label them differently. But my sincere belief in engaging with a number of CEOs across a number of companies, regardless of segment, midstream, oil field services, utilities, renewable or fossil fuel generation, refiners, upstream players, they all have a strategy for dealing with the energy transition. And I think they're all facing into it. And no one is taking a back foot or letting their foot off the gas just because the climate environment might be shifting.
Well, Regina, you're putting a fine point on why I wanted to talk to you, because I hadn't actually thought about environment and climate as dropping, as in fact, perhaps a recognition of how normalized those topics have become, how central they are to the business. They're not the new volatility. They're kind of the new part of running your operation. So that's a really interesting way to think about it. Let's go down one more step. You mentioned polarized, and nothing's more polarized in that little space right now than ESG or anti-ESG. When you spoke earlier this year, one key takeaway for me was how CEOs are thinking about ESG in the context of value creation. And I'm glad you keep pointing out that this is about risk to growth. So like risk to value creation, risk to making sure that you're creating something for your employees, your stakeholders, your shareholders. How do you think about ESG and how do you see CEOs thinking about ESG in the context of value creation?
So I love the term that you use there, Tisha, with normalization. I think that's actually, it's so spot on and I will adopt that. Because I do think it's just something that you're managing in the normal course of business. How do they manage it for value creation? I think it comes into play in a number of different conversations. So first is, what are your scope 1 and scope 2 emissions? And what is your plan for reducing / eliminating that? And what targets have you set? There are things that you can get after today, eliminating flaring, capturing fugitive methane emissions, being able to use clean energy in powering your products that are drilling, your well site activities and things of that nature. Then they are looking at, what marginal investments am I going to make to continue to invest in hydrocarbons today? Because these are long cycle decisions. And if you're in the camp that you believe peak oil demand is 2030, are you really going to go explore in this new track off of Western Africa, or you pick a point in the world? Or are you going to say, that's not going to be in our arsenal? And then are you even going to extend, right, your Gulf of Mexico or whatever existing activities that you have? So you've got those choices to make. And then you're investing in new businesses that will drive the lower carbon economy, be that carbon capture sequestration, be it hydrogen, be it low carbon natural gas or LNG. And those, again, are very long cycle investment strategies. Or be it sustainable aviation fuel and biofuels and things of that nature. So all of that is coming together in energy companies' capital allocation, budgeting, planning, forecasting, as they make those decisions. And I think it's incredibly complex. So it's not an ESG, am I pro, am I anti? It's, how do I steer this company? How am I going to compete? Like I said, do I think that I'm got one of the last marginal gallons of gasoline or one of the last marginal barrels of hydrocarbons to compete with the Saudis in the Middle East? And then I'm going to continue to invest in that, and I'm going to continue to drive shareholder return. And then at which point am I going to pivot to drive a new energy type of a business? And there is no, it's not flipping a switch. You have to have all of those trains of thought and investment going all at the same time. And you have to be able to tell that story to your shareholders in a clear and compelling and convincing fashion.
Yeah, it's such a great point. And as we think about this idea of normalizing around climate and environmental there's so much drama happening right now around anti-ESG. And what is the job? What's the political job of the CEO in pushing or not pushing these agendas? And so we've been thinking at Adam and Teen with our clients a lot about language. And when something gets really hot, really polarized. For example, we have been moving away from ESG and talking about sustainability, but sustainability in this broader context that includes value, includes durability of the plans, which I think is a lot about what you're talking about. But I'm curious, where's your advice going around language and helping CEOs find this trajectory between the climate and environmental pressure, which, you know, we've said is normalized, but also that acknowledges this very acute anti-ESG backlash that executives are facing, say, in red states where they operate?
The way I see them talking about it is they're talking more about the outcomes and not labeling things. So am I looking at decarbonizing my operations to address my scope one and scope two emissions? And if you are, there's 3,000 companies in the US that are caught up in having to report CSRD, which is an EU regulation. But because these are massive global companies, they have operations in the EU, and they're going to have to backward integrate those regulations. So they're required to start reporting, they have been reporting, don't get me wrong, but they're even required to make that a regulatory component. So I think they're staying away from the flashpoint phrases and focusing on the outcomes and the things that they know that their shareholders want them to talk about.
That's a really great way to think about it, because it continues with that idea of normalizing, which is make sure that everything you're doing is ultimately contributing to your goals and thinking about it in that context. One of the areas that continues to have a lot of political backlash is around diversity, equity, and inclusion strategy. That is super hot and also super fraught at the moment in ways that I think are unfortunate. I'm curious, what are you seeing from CEOs on how they are valuing diversity, equity, inclusion, and navigating this backlash when I think we were actually just starting to make some really good progress? So it's something that I'm really curious about what you're seeing out there, and then also how you're advising your clients on that.
Yeah, so I think it falls under the same, let's not put a label on it, IDE, DEI, whatever you want to call it. And we're not even going to necessarily highlight it, but it remains an important focus. I do find that trend a bit troubling as a woman in energy, where I've been advocating on behalf of women. And I think that we can contribute a lot in terms of our ability to help navigate the energy transition and things that we can do in terms of how we lead. When you talk about the use of AI or technology, just to share a quick anecdote with you, when I was in Davos in January, I got to lead a panel on women leadership, and I had a senior executive from Meta, a senior executive from Salesforce, and a female CEO from a startup. And we talked about how when AI, hopefully the promise of AI, is it eliminates a lot of the routine process transaction management, and you're going to need leaders that have empathy, intuition. The age of the, this is one of the phrases, the brilliant jerk is no longer part of who we want to be, right? And that's why I think female leadership will come to the fore, and there's many, many more of the attributes and things that we can bring to the organization. I tend to be more of an eternal optimist, more of a glass half full when it comes to the industry and what I see. But I believe 90% of the CEOs that I interact with are all still, their hearts are in the right place. They believe in the importance of diversity of thought, diversity of experience. Our own lived experiences are all different. And they've seen the value that they get with having diverse voices at the table. Whether or not they label it or tout their DEI metrics at the risk of someone somewhere throwing a stone at it, maybe they don't, but I think they understand the importance and they'll continue to progress those initiatives.
I love your optimism. And in preparing for this podcast, I got to listen to a lot of your interviews about the promise of AI in a split screen world where half the people are catastrophizing. I actually love the way you find these lanes of optimism, so which I consider pragmatic. It's not all in, everything's roses. So I'm curious, let's apply that to your experience at Davos, for example. So oil and gas leaders who are participating more than ever before in these conversations around the future of energy and addressing climate proactively, often they find they're not invited to the table or not welcome. I am often encouraging these leaders to show up anyway, but I think that it would be helpful to pair that with some pragmatic advice from you, Regina, on what do you think oil and gas companies and leaders need to do to build that trust, to earn that seat at the table. So it's not just that you're invited and you show up, but what do we do in between the Davoses and the COPs to make sure that our companies are building the track record that will allow other leaders, other stakeholders to feel that they are sincere in their efforts?
I think it depends on what stakeholder group you're talking about. So I did have the opportunity to visit with quite a few CEOs now that I'm back home in Houston that didn't go to Davos and didn't go to COP. And I'm, you know, walking around Houston and sharing the benefits of those insights. And they kind of asked me, should they have gone? Should they be participating more actively? Several of them are very, very active with the US government and just educating our legislative officials, as well as cabinet level officials, about why Keystone Pipeline couldn't get built. It wasn't just an executive order, like how permitting works, what it means when you have a lease in the Gulf of Mexico, and whether or not you're going to take action to explore and drill against. And they invest quite a lot of time in Washington. And I applaud them very, very much. I think I'm just incredibly grateful that that's where they're leaning in. And they do it in a non-confrontational way, a non-polarizing way. They're not lobbying. They're here to befriend, educate, et cetera. So I think that's one area. Another area is, you know, the difference between the integrated oil companies and the national oil companies. One of the CEOs that I spoke with that was at COP, his big emphasis was this Dr. Sultan, the CEO of ADNOC, was the leader of the entire event. And I think he did a masterful job. They did achieve quite a bit, given the fact that it was centered in an oil-rich part of the world, right? But the NOCs have a lot to do when it comes to flaring in the Middle East and fugitive methane emissions and wells that have been abandoned but not properly shut down yet. So there's a whole tranche of action that the IOCs have been doing and the NOCs could be encouraged to do more that would have great impact for the overall planet. And then there are other businesses that are more effective at communicating with the everyday person, right? Do you realize all the pieces of your Tesla that actually stem from a barrel of oil in the first place, right? And how do we create different fabrics so that we're not reliant on yoga pants that actually come from a barrel of oil? So I think the different pieces of the industry are leaning in different ways and in different areas. And that together collectively is helping to change the narrative, because we can't just do stuff in the West and expect that we're going to heal the planet. Like, carbon atoms don't carry passports. And notably, one of the senior leaders from Africa, their representative, stood on the floor of the COP forum and said, we will be the very last country that segues off of fossil fuels. My words, not hers. All y'all can get off of fossil fuels before we do, but we are not going to sacrifice the benefits that we can give to our population by driving wealth creation through electrification and access to things that improve the quality of our lives.
Yeah, Regina, that amplifies. We had two guests ago. We had Samer El-Shabi, who was leading the climate and energy discussions there. He made a passionate and, I thought, compelling pitch for U.S. companies to join the International Oil and Gas Decarbonization Charter for that reason, for a way of participating, not without controversy in the U.S., but part of this trajectory and conversation that leaders have the opportunity to participate in different ways. I want to go back a little bit to AI because, as I mentioned, I've been following your work here with interest. Obviously, you mentioned it has a ton of buzz among CEOs, particularly 70% of executives said it is their top investment priority. So I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about what you see as the promising implications for the oil and gas industry, or maybe for energy and climate. What do you find most promising? And have you been advising companies about how to participate in this space?
Well, it's very early days, Tisha. So I think there's more hype than reality at this point, but there is promise. So this isn't one of those, we're all talking about the metaverse, and we're all going to be walking around with 3D glasses, and then suddenly nobody talks about the metaverse, or blockchain was going to solve world hunger. This is going to be a massive game changer, and the companies are all getting ready for it. A couple of things that they are doing, but one of them is they're just unleashing the technology. So KPMG's one, we are early adopters of the Microsoft Copilot solution, bought thousands of licenses, putting them on desktops, laptops for all of our employees, not all, but many of our employees, to just play around with it and see what you can do to start driving productivity. Simple things like managing schedules and looking at contracts and even responding to emails. I mean, we are all inundated. So are there little productivity tools that can make our day-to-day jobs better and free up our minds to do different, better, more fun, more interesting things? So I think that's one is access. I think the biggest challenge is creating the right, I'm a very technical person, so I'm going to use this very technical term, the right bubble for your stuff to sit inside. You don't want those crown jewels to go from, if you're an upstream player, you wouldn't want your sensitive geological and, you know, all your 3D, 4D seismic and the, you know, the things that you want to, where you think there's hydrocarbons unlocked somewhere. You wouldn't want that on the dark web. So how do you create the right barriers so that you can create the right sandboxes for people to play in so that you can then unleash the power of the tool? Even in our business, it's super challenging because, right, we have access to people's financial records. We advise on deals. We audit. We do people's taxes. And even when we respond to a publicly available or an RFP and we give a response, that RFP has our client's data embedded in it. So you have to be very, very precise about how you, number one, protect your own information. Number two, protect the information that's not yours, that you're not allowed to use. And then number three, figure out how to democratize that to get your brightest minds playing with it. So I haven't seen a ton of people solve all of those variables yet. Those companies that have their data in order already will definitely be able to leapfrog. And there are some that have made really good investments in data lakes and getting ready for big ERP transitions that have made those investments. But we haven't seen as much of that yet. And then we're also worried about the cyber piece. No doubt it's going to be game changing. But I kind of get lost in a lot of these requirements just to get up and running. And I think that's going to be a much higher hurdle than one would anticipate.
I'm excited because I also am a glass half full kind of gallon. If I can spend my time on more creative or emotionally fulfilling pursuits, I'm all for less email responses. Regina, one final question for you that I ask all my guests. What are you most optimistic about?
One of the things I didn't get to talk about is just the experience of being in Dubai for COP28. And that was wholly energizing. And that is what made me, I came away just feeling incredibly optimistic. You know, you could have looked at that event from two sides of a coin. It was like a series of dichotomies, right? On the one hand, you had 84,000 people that showed up in the desert to talk about climate change, most of whom flew business class or even private, most of whom took private cars to the venue. It was held in the sweltering desert, so it had to be air conditioned. The pavilions were all created overnight. So you just think about the waste and what that carbon footprint looked like. At the same time, 84,000 people showed up in the desert to talk about climate change. And when you saw how young everyone was and how exuberant and how energetic and how committed they are to making the world a better place, and you saw the people from the Pacific Islands show up in their national dress and the colors and the excitement and the sounds and the different languages, I walked away saying, we're going to do this. Like, we as a population, a global, integrated, connected population can figure this out. And that's what I'm most optimistic about. And so I think AI is just going to make that even easier as more people have more technology at their hands and their fingertips to do things for good. I get it. People will continue to also do things for bad. But I think there's more people out there doing things for good. And I feel like I saw it in action when I was in Dubai in the sweltering hot desert, rubbing elbows with 84,000 people. So that's what I'm most optimistic about.
That's a wonderful example. And it's great to leave us with the idea that two opposing ideas can be true at the same time. You can have 84,000 people with a big climate footprint coming together to make addressing our global climate footprint possible. And I think that's a great place to leave us. Thank you so much for joining me, Regina.
Thank you, Tisha. And I learned that from you. Two things can be the truth at the same time. So thank you.
Thank you. That's our episode today. Thanks so much to Regina Mayer for joining me. I enjoyed hearing about the optimism she took from being at COP. Sometimes I imagine that those sorts of gatherings are just exhausting. That's how I often find big gatherings. But everyone I talked to who came back from COP was so energized by it. And I love the connectivity between Samer's podcast and Regina's. I'd love to hear about what you found interesting. I hope you'll reach out to us at adamandteen@energythinks.com. If you like what you're hearing, please help others in the oil and gas industry find this podcast by taking a moment to rate and review us. I am so grateful that Kayla Chives is joining me and making the Energy Thinks podcast possible. I'd also like to thank Lindsay Slaughter for all her help in this episode. Until next time, I'm Tisha Schuler, wishing you and yours happiness, prosperity, and good health.